Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, July 10th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now let's get started with an intro by Krista Case Bryant, editor. You may have noticed in recent months a focus on getting you timely, relevant news stories. That's deliberate. A key way we've been doing that is through our expanded news briefs, many composed by our staff writers in bureaus around the world. We're introducing another change this weekend with the launch of a new Saturday send. This means the stories we prepare on Friday will reach you with more timely insights. On Monday mornings, meanwhile, you can expect a fresh feed of timely briefs to start your week. And now let's move on to news briefs. The Trump administration sued California's Department of Education. It alleged a Title IX violation Wednesday for allowing transgender student-athletes to participate in female sports. California had rejected a resolution agreement calling for measures including rescinding recognition of transgender athletes' achievements. The legal escalation jeopardizes the state's education funding and marks the latest tension between the White House and the Democrat-led state. President Trump singled Brazil out with 50% tariffs. He tied the tariffs to the trial of former right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro, charged with trying to overturn his 2022 election loss, calling the case a witch hunt. The tariffs starting August 1st would be a dramatic increase from the 10% rate announced in April. France and the UK are trying again to stop migrant crossings. Each year, thousands of migrants cross the channel from France to England in small boats, with numbers rising significantly in 2025. Migration is a key issue for a three-day summit concluding today in London, alongside economic growth and defense. Russia was found guilty of violating international law. The European Court of Human Rights found that Moscow was responsible for widespread violations from the shooting down of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 in 2014 to the kidnapping of Ukrainian children after Moscow's 2022 invasion. It's the first time an international court has found widespread Russian human rights abuses in Ukraine. New Mexico sought help after flooding. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham signed an emergency declaration late Tuesday seeking federal aid to help Ruidoso in the southern part of the state recover from flash floods that killed a father and two children. Earlier this week, the mayor of Ruidoso asked state lawmakers for help preparing for flood risks, saying wildfires last year had left his community vulnerable to flash flooding. Kenya's president broke his silence on protests. Clashes have left 50 people dead in 2 weeks, with hundreds injured and arrested. President William Ruto urged police to shoot in the leg those who stole and burned property during the demonstrations. Critics have called his remarks reckless, warning they could escalate violence. Indian workers launched a nationwide strike, disrupting coal mining, banking, and public transport. Hundreds of thousands of workers are protesting Prime Minister Narendra Modi's privatization efforts and demanding higher wages and the scrapping of new labor laws. The government defends the reforms as necessary for economic growth. Paris opened the Seine for swimming after a century-long ban. Following an ambitious and costly cleanup, the river is finally passing its water quality tests and open to the public, delighting families and hardcore urban swimmers alike. In cities across Europe, residents are working to reclaim polluted waterways for swim and play. And now for our first story. In Texas flood response, a scaled-back FEMA gets an early test. Since its founding in 1979, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has spent, on average, $12 billion helping communities respond to natural disasters. The Texas flood tragedy, coming just weeks after President Donald Trump pledged to dissolve the agency, is now sharpening debate over Washington's role in helping citizens in distress. The administration has argued that states should bear the primary responsibility for disaster response and recovery. Others argue that a piecemeal response will result in new vulnerabilities. By Patrick Johnson. As the response on the ground in Texas shifts from rescue to recovery efforts, the Federal Emergency Management Agency's ability to provide timely aid to states is once again front and center. The Texas tragedy, in which flash flooding over the 4th of July weekend left more than 100 dead, including 36 children, with more than 170 still missing, comes amid a widening debate over the federal government's role in responding to natural disasters and whether to revamp or even dismantle FEMA. On Sunday, just weeks after pledging to dissolve the agency, President Donald Trump declared the flood zone in Texas a major disaster, activating FEMA resources and releasing funds to help with rescue and recovery operations. Speaking to reporters, the president said that now wasn't the time to discuss FEMA's future. FEMA is something we can talk about later, the president said. Since Mr. Trump took office, however, the agency's staff has reportedly been reduced by as much as 25% as a result of buyouts and layoffs instituted by the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE. FEMA's former acting administrator was pushed out in May after he testified before Congress that he did not think the agency should be eliminated. At a cabinet meeting Tuesday, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said the administration was streamlining FEMA, emphasizing that the state of Texas was leading the response on the ground, with the federal government playing a supporting role. The New York Times reported that many current and former FEMA officials characterized the federal presence in Texas as notably smaller than what they would have expected for a disaster of this magnitude. Conservatives have criticized FEMA in recent years for inefficiencies and layers of red tape that they say make it difficult for survivors to access support. Still, others contend that while FEMA might need to be revamped, the agency is playing an ever more crucial role as states struggle to meet the rising costs and challenges of natural disasters now occurring with more frequency and severity. The agency's response to immense flooding in the Texas Hill Country may offer a window into how a reimagined FEMA under the Trump administration will operate as the federal government looks to scale back its role. The Texas flooding is a focusing event, says Susan Cutter, co-director of the Hazards Vulnerability and Resilience Institute at the University of South Carolina. It gives us a path forward or not, a path that we take collectively, or we start going down the road of a piecemeal response. Mr. Trump has long criticized FEMA as a politicized behemoth that has lost track of its mission. FEMA has been a very big disappointment, the president said during a visit in January to North Carolina, where mountain communities are still recovering from destruction caused by last year's Hurricane Helene. It's very bureaucratic and it's very slow. The president has criticized the agency's response to the Los Angeles wildfires and Hurricane Helene, which left at least 230 people dead in southern Appalachia. The agency is reportedly behind schedule in processing emergency grants, many of which have been paused or canceled as part of budget cuts. We've been ghosted by FEMA, Robert Wyke Graham, Deputy Director of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Emergency Management, told CNN last week, describing the agency's lack of response to requests for information about his North Carolina community. 9 months after Helene's historic floods devastated many North Carolina mountain communities, most of the region is back open for business. But almost half of the state's population, 43%, said FEMA's response was poor or very poor, according to recent polling. Critics also accuse FEMA of mission creep as the agency's operations expanded beyond handling logistics and cutting checks in the wake of disasters. It was involved in much of the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. It has played a role in migrant housing. FEMA even trains agencies on how to police protests, and they don't do it well, says Edward McGuire, a criminologist at Arizona State University in Tempe. These expanding roles have often come without additional resources. While it's not uncommon for Washington to deny petitions for disaster relief funds, under President Trump, FEMA has refused requests after tornadoes in Arkansas and flooding in West Virginia. The agency also eliminated funding for hazard mitigation, including money for elevating or demolishing flood-prone homes and strengthening buildings in hurricane and earthquake zones. Yet, as the Trump administration shifts more costs of and responsibilities for managing disasters onto the states, some worry about disparate outcomes. Wyoming officials say their recent request for information about federal funds, which make up almost all of the state's emergency management budget, have gone unanswered. Texas, which spent $547 million this year on improving its emergency preparedness, has been requesting assistance from Washington for its communities affected by rainfall and flooding since this past spring. With this latest flood, Governor Greg Abbott requested an emergency declaration to mobilize FEMA. Ms. Noem told reporters Tuesday that the FEMA response in Texas was the model for the agency moving forward. We, as a federal government, don't manage these disasters. The state does, she said. We come in and support them. As soon as the president approved the disaster declaration for Texas, she said, we were able to get them resources and dollars right away through state block grants to help them with cleanup. On Wednesday, the FEMA Review Council, a task force set up by President Trump to recommend changes to the agency structure, held its second meeting. Reforming FEMA is not nearly as simple as it should be, Ms. Noem said in her opening remarks. Founded in 1979 by President Jimmy Carter, FEMA was itself originally an effort to streamline the U.S. emergency response by consolidating several existing federal disaster-related agencies. In 2003, the agency was transferred to the newly formed Department of Homeland Security. Over the past 30 years, it has spent an average of $12 billion per year dealing with disasters across the country, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Eliminating FEMA entirely would require an act of Congress, but already many FEMA operations have been paused or eliminated, according to May testimony from the Natural Resources Defense Council to Congress. The Trump administration has considered changing policies to make it more difficult for states to receive funding after disasters, according to Bloomberg News, which cited an internal agency memo from March. The proposed changes, which include limiting long-term housing assistance and halting enrollment in the National Flood Insurance Program, would amount to a dramatic reduction in the federal government's role in disaster response. FEMA's Command Center director in charge of coordinating flood responses resigned in June after Mr. Trump announced plans to phase out the agency. States are now expected to share more of the recovery costs and must request assistance directly from the Oval Office. This every state for itself approach was once the norm, says Robert Griffin, a former Homeland Security Undersecretary. But starting in the mid-20th century, the level of devastation of some of these events surpassed the capacity of the states and locals to respond, recover, and rebuild. It called out for a national presence. FEMA was formed in part to bring unique federal resources that locals can't afford, the fleets of helicopters, the search and rescue teams, the mortuary teams, the medical support teams, says Professor Griffin, who now serves as founding dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Now, as the federal government scales back its role, he says, it raises questions about how the president will decide which states get aid and which don't, and what will happen to the states with fewer resources if they are denied federal aid. Next story. We fed ourselves from that soil, what Israeli buffer zones cost Gazans. Mohammed Abu Mitlek no longer dares step foot on his farmland in Gaza. The greenhouses he built by hand, the rows of 120 apricot trees, 300 peach trees, and 70 olive trees he tended on soil his family has farmed for generations. If I try to reach it, I'll be sniped, bombed, or both, he says. Throughout the war in Gaza, Israeli buffer zones have steadily expanded through a series of evacuation orders. While the orders are often framed as security precautions for many Palestinians, they appear to be part of a slow-motion land grab. It's not just my field they've taken, Mr. Abu Mitlek says. It's our future. By Gada Abdul Fattah, reporting from Dair al-Balah, Gaza Strip. Mohammed Abu Mitlek no longer dares step foot on his farmland. The greenhouses he built by hand, the rows of 120 apricot trees, 300 peach trees, and 70 olive trees he tended on soil his family has farmed for generations all lie inside a zone that could mean instant death upon entering. If I try to reach it, I'll be sniped, bombed, or both, he says. That land is no longer accessible, not to me, not to anyone. The father of 11 chose farming in the Gaza Strip border town of Kuzah in southeast Khan Yunis, carrying on the family profession on the 8.4 acres of fruit and olive groves he inherited from his father. Today, that land sits in what Israel has declared an expanded buffer zone on the Gaza-Israel border, directly opposite kibbutz near Oz, the Israeli farming community worst hit by Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack. The Israeli military has declared Kuzah, like many areas in Gaza, to be a dangerous combat zone, preventing residents from returning home. Throughout the Israel-Hamas war, zones such as these have been methodically expanded through a series of evacuation orders. In this way, Israel has now restricted Palestinians' access to 85% of Gaza, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA. While the displacement orders and designation of zones as off-limits are often framed by Israeli authorities as security precautions, for many Palestinians, they appear to be part of a more deliberate, slow-motion land grab. It is dispossessing Palestinians of both their homes and their livelihoods. "They want to swallow our land, meter by meter," Mr. Abu Mitlek says. "It's not just my field they've taken, it's our future." Aerial imagery shared by Israeli media shows scorched fields, bulldozed orchards, and flattened homes across Kuzah. Local residents confirm the destruction. The apricot trees are gone, livestock pens empty. "It's as if everything I built over decades was erased overnight," Mr. Abu Mitlek says. Najah Kadeh used to live a life deeply rooted in Kuzah. "I remember walking to the fields with my mother, grandmother, brothers and sisters," says Ms. Kadeh. On land inherited from her family, she and her husband used to cultivate rows of olives, oranges, lemons, and other citrus trees, filled in between with onions, garlic, and parsley. "We used to grow enough to feed ourselves, our neighbors, and even sell a little," she says. Ms. Kadeh raised 9 children, 6 sons and 3 daughters, on that land. She also kept doves, rabbits, and chickens. "We lived the typical peasant life," she says, "simple, but full of pride." Ms. Kadeh and her husband were preparing for the olive harvest when Hamas launched its attack on Israel. Ms. Kadeh's son, Suhaib, had risked his life to sneak back into Kuzah to plant tomatoes and check on the land. Now he cannot even attempt a return due to ongoing Israeli military operations. "We were the first to be displaced, the first to be abused," says Mr. Abu Mitlek. "No one knows if we'll be able to return to our homes." Hanan Al-Kafarna last saw her half acre of land in Beit Hanun in northern Gaza on October 6, 2023. Since then, she hasn't heard any news about it or even caught a glimpse of it on social media. During the nearly 2-month ceasefire this year, neither she nor her 9 children could approach the land. It lay out of reach, off limits, in the Israeli buffer zone. Before the war, Ms. Kafarna and her husband worked their small plot of land themselves. "We fed ourselves from that soil," she says, seated on a plastic mat inside a displacement camp in Gaza City. "Guava, lemon, melons, eggplant, whatever the season gave us, we used it. We ate from it and sold the rest to neighbors. It wasn't much, but it was ours. Now that life is gone. So too is their ability to feed their family. We had chickens, goats. The land kept us alive, even in the hardest years. We never had much money, but we never went hungry. We had offers in the past. People wanted to buy the land. We always refused. I told my children, 'You do not sell the land. Ever.' One of her sons tried to reach it during the ceasefire, risking his life to see if anything was left. He came back empty-handed. He said, 'It's a red zone,' Ms. Kafarna says. 'The army doesn't let anyone near it.'" Even as Ms. Kadeh's family contemplates leaving Gaza, she resists. "I refused. Kuzah is in my soul. The air is clean. The people are connected. We knew our neighbors, our aunts, uncles, our children. We were all close. Now we are scattered, dispersed. Aerial photos from the area shared by Israeli news sites showed Kuzah as a ghost town. Back then we lived, she says, at the time before the war. Now we just survive. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the print Disabled. 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story. In Canada's Arctic, national security is a military and civic responsibility. With climate change thawing the Arctic and great powers looking to gain influence in the region, Canada is turning its attention to northern security, but not by just dropping tanks in the tundra. Rather, it is pouring money into both military and northern communities to bolster regional safety and awareness. Volunteer Canadian Army reservists who have long had a mandate to serve as eyes and ears of the North are among those standing to directly benefit, but they are among those advocating for a big tent vision of what Arctic security means, and the Yukon, one of three Canadian Arctic territories, is modeling how. By Sarah Miller-Yana, reporting from Whitehorse, Yukon. Stephen Wells was trained in the Air Force to work on F-16 fighter jets, including critical radar, navigation, and weapon systems. Yet when he later tried to apply that expertise toward an education at Pittsburgh's Community College of Allegheny County, he was given just 3 credits in physical education. Mr. Wells moved forward anyway, going on to get his bachelor's and doctoral degrees. Now he's CCAC's provost and involved in a citywide project to help other people, especially the increasing number who started but never completed a degree, transform their military and work experience into academic credit. Sorry, that was the next story. I haven't finished the Canadian Arctic one. I'm going to go back to that one. Here we go. Sorry about that. The last ranger on the rope line falls backward down the icy hillside he is climbing, pulling those ahead of him down too. "Axes out," yells Sergeant Jim Welsh of the Whitehorse Canadian Ranger Patrol. "Pick side in." The group of 4 in t-shirts on a June day with almost 24 hours sun follows his commands, stopping their fall on a ski slope, still covered with patches of snow, outside the capital of the Yukon in Canada's far northwest. The group is training for a month-long mission this July to the Canadian High Arctic. They're learning what to do if a team member falls into a crevasse along the ice field they will be traversing. Exploring some of the world's most inhospitable landscapes is a typical mission for the Rangers, who are volunteer Canadian Army reservists whose mandate has long been to serve as eyes and ears of the North. But the stakes of their patrols have gotten much higher. Russia, which boasts the most Arctic territory of any country, has broken the post-war order with its 2022 invasion of Ukraine. China, in a power struggle for global dominance, has declared itself a near-Arctic state. Global warming has opened up the Northwest Passages to vessels that were once iced out. And the United States is no longer a partner that Western allies trust. In response, Canada is pouring money into defense spending and forces like the Rangers stand to directly benefit. But they are among those advocating for a Big Ten vision of what Arctic security means. And the Yukon, one of three Canadian Arctic territories, is modeling how. In March, the territorial government opened the Canadian Institute for Arctic Security, which works closely with Rangers and other military branches, as well as the federal government. Indigenous governments and international partners to redefine what it means to keep the North safe. It's part of a larger global rethink of defense spending, not as a zero-sum game pitting military against social spending, but as a win for both countries and communities. We aren't going to secure the Arctic by arming it, says Sergeant Welsh, but if our communities are strong and our people are trained and our people are on the land, then they're going to see when there's something weird happening, an unregistered boat in the water or that mining operation on an Arctic island. Living safely north of 60, 40% of Canada's landmass lies in the Arctic, trailing only Russia. But Canada's Arctic security has generally gone unscrutinized outside of times of crisis, the last one being the Cold War. But over the past decade, as a warming climate has changed the landscape, and particularly since 2022, amid rapidly changing geopolitics, Arctic security has jumped back up the list of Canada's priorities. Canada said it would name a new Arctic ambassador and open Canadian Arctic consulates in Alaska and Greenland. In March, Canada's Defense Ministry announced a massive expansion across the North with the creation of new hubs, including airstrips and equipment to support a more constant presence of Canadian armed forces. In June, Prime Minister Mark Carney announced a cash increase of over $9 billion Canadian, $6.6 billion U.S., in Canadian defense spending overall to meet NATO member targets of 2% of gross domestic product by March 2026, saying that threats which felt far away and remote are now immediate and acute. A few weeks later, at the annual NATO summit held at The Hague, Canada, along with most NATO allies, pledged to ratchet up that spending again, this time to 5% of GDP by 2032. But within that target, members can earmark 1.5% for civilian infrastructure like roads and better telecommunications that serve both the military and communities. That's the philosophy underpinning the Yukon's goals for a more secure Arctic. The Yukon sits north of 60, the latitude that demarcates Canada's three Arctic territories. But its land north of the Arctic Circle is largely unpopulated, save for one fly-in community, protected on its western flank by Alaska and buffered by hundreds of miles of Canadian wilderness from the North Atlantic. The Yukon receives less military attention than its neighbors. That changed in early 2023 when a high-altitude balloon originating from China flew across Alaska, western Canada, and then the mainland U.S. before it was finally shot down by the U.S. Air Force off the coast of South Carolina. Ranj Pillai had only been the premier of the Yukon for 1 month in February 2023, when another object was shot down over traditional indigenous lands in the Yukon by the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, a joint U.S.-Canada unit created during the Cold War. Military officials and police swarmed into central Yukon to find it. Rangers helped them understand the terrain, but no one knew who to call or how to share information, especially with Indigenous governments. We watched the Canadian Armed Forces mobilize, but we saw gaps in their ability to communicate with people in Yukon, says Mr. Pillai, who stepped down as premier in June. He is still a member of the territorial legislature. The object, which was never recovered, was deemed not to be a surveillance balloon from China, but it spurred the province to change. Mr. Pillai finalized the creation of the Yukon Arctic Security Advisory Council and the Canadian Institute of Arctic Security. The institute is currently government-run, but aims to be an independent think tank, says Andrew Smith, who runs it. The institute launched with its first major conference in March. A month later, the Assembly of First Nations Yukon Region, which works with the first 14 of First Nations in the Yukon, held an Arctic Security Industries Conference. The Arctic Institute aims to help foster Arctic security development opportunities for First Nations in the territory. It also promotes dual-use infrastructure, the kind touted in NATO's 1.5% defense spending category. For example, the Dempster Highway is the only all-season public road in Canada that can be driven to the Arctic Ocean. But its 750 kilometers, 466 miles, is unpaved with hardly any services. If it were made suitable for military use, that modernization would also benefit remote communities. The security spectrum we're looking at is extremely broad, says Mr. Smith. It is from missile defense and space tech to food supply chains and health care. That ensures communities remain vibrant and viable, he says, which is a demonstration of sovereignty and therefore deterrence. Mr. Pillai accomplished one of his main goals on June 23rd. The monitor joined two temporary Navy reservists on their first day of work in Whitehorse. They are there to assess the viability of a more permanent Navy reserve after they ascertain what the community needs and wants. It's all part of what Mr. Pillai calls a sustainable Arctic defense establishment. That is the baseline for sovereignty, he says, when people are thriving in their lives across the north of Canada. Patrolling the high north. The frenzied global conversation around Arctic security belies what Michael Byers, the author of Who Owns the Arctic, sees as the counter-narrative. Canadian Arctic sovereignty is more secure than people think, he says. Despite turbulent relations with the U.S., Canada, and America, are still steadfast military allies. The Rangers, numbering 5,000, are a formidable force, officially established in 1947 in the Yukon, first in Dawson City and then in Whitehorse. A quarter are Indigenous, and while it's not a full-time job, they're paid for their services and their equipment, which allows them to explore the harsh environment of the Arctic. Cooperation in the Arctic is not only the norm, it's necessary given its vast size. And Canada has led the way, chairing the first Arctic Council in 1996. It has invested in first-class ice cutters and Earth imaging satellites that provide data on Arctic ice. And climate change has altered landscapes, but most of the threats that pose are constabulary, like drug and human smuggling or search and rescue. The challenges are real, Dr. Byers says. In fact, they're truly massive. but they don't involve any invasion by another state. Many First Nations leaders say they are happy to be formally included in emerging discussions about Arctic security. First Nations need to be involved in Arctic security because of the openness of the oceans up there, says Donna Hope, chief of the Natcho-Nyak-Dun First Nation, in whose traditional land the object was shut down. But Darren Taylor, chief of the Trondekwetchwin First Nation in Dawson City, who shares overlapping traditional territory where the object landed, says he worries about Canada opening itself to war by defending itself from war. I think we need to show our presence up north and be able to defend any threat that's potentially coming, but we can't increase the possibility of that threat also by way of our actions as a country, says Chief Taylor. That is a concern that Mr. Smith hears and understands, but he says it is hard to measure prevention versus deterrence. And the world that many of us grew up in or matured in is fading away, either by political change, changes in societies, or climate change, he says. His institute, he says, wasn't created out of fear. He wishes it began without the backdrop of current geopolitical tensions. But as it is, the Arctic is once again on the agenda, and policy is created in Ottawa. Canada is as wide as it is long, yet most Canadians live within 60 miles of the U.S.-Canada border. Heather Exner-Pirot, Senior Fellow and Director of Energy, Natural Resources, and Environment at the MacDonald Laurier Institute, says the Arctic is exotic to most Canadians, and that doesn't inform good policy. Ken Coates, who chaired the Yukon Arctic Security Advisory Council, sees the Yukon trying to change that. The Yukon is really trying to be constructive, so it's not whining. It's not sort of sitting there and saying, hey, give us four soldiers and a tank. They're saying, if you look at this, we can give back as much as we take. Many Yukoners want to give back, at least judging from Sergeant Welsh's telephone line. The longtime ranger who spent a month in the high Arctic this winter supporting NATO military operations in the extreme cold says he's getting near daily phone calls about how to join the volunteer service. Last year the phone would ring about once a month. And there are all kinds of patrols happening all over the Arctic this summer. We're going to more remote locations than we've ever been to. And we are doing bigger, harder things, he says. We are giving back something meaningful to northern communities. And there's an appetite to show that we're a meaningful, contributing part of the Canadian military. In other words, a win-win. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the Print Disabled. And now we'll go back to the next story. Credit for life experience. More colleges woo students with path to degrees. By John Marcus, Pittsburgh. Stephen Wells was trained in the Air Force to work on F-16 fighter jets, including critical radar navigation and weapons systems whose proper functioning meant life or death for pilots. Yet when he left the service and tried to apply that expertise toward an education at Pittsburgh's Community College of Allegheny County, or CCAC, he was given just 3 credits toward a required class in physical education. Mr. Wells moved forward anyway, going on to get his bachelor's and doctoral degrees. Now, he's CCAC's provost and involved in a citywide project to help other people transform their military and work experience into academic credit. What's happening in Pittsburgh is part of growing national momentum behind letting students, especially the increasing number who started but never completed a degree, cash in their life skills toward finally getting one, saving them time and money. Colleges and universities have long purported to provide what's known in higher education as credit for prior learning, but they've made the process so complex, slow, and expensive that only about 1 in 10 students actually completes it. Many students don't even try, especially low-income learners who could benefit the most, according to a study by the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education and the Council for Adult and Experiential Learning, or CAEL. It drives me nuts that this promise has historically proven so elusive, Mr. Wells says. In his college's new Center for Education, Innovation, and Training. That appears to be changing. Nearly half of institutions surveyed last year by the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers, or AACRAO, say they have added more ways for students to receive these credits. Electricians, for example, can apply some of their training toward academic courses in electrical engineering, and daycare workers can use their experience to earn degrees in teaching. The reason universities and colleges are doing this is simple. Nearly 38 million working-age Americans have spent some time in college but never finished, according to the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. Getting at least some of them to come back has become essential to these higher education institutions at a time when changing demographics mean that the number of 18-year-old high school graduates is falling. When higher education institutions are fat and happy, nobody looks for these things. Only when those traditional pipelines dry up do we start looking for other potential populations, says Jeffrey Harmon, Vice Provost for Strategic Initiatives and Institutional Effectiveness at Thomas Edison State University in New Jersey, which has long given adult learners credit for the skills they bring. A tool for recruiting. Being able to get credit for prior learning is a huge potential recruiting tool. 84% of adults who are leaning toward going back to college say it would have a strong influence on their decision, according to research by CAEL, the Strata Education Foundation, and Hanover Research. Strata is among the funders of the Hechinger Report, which produced this story. When Melissa DiMatteo decided to get an associate degree at CCAC to go further in her job, she got 6 credits for her previous training in Microsoft Office and her work experience as everything from a receptionist to a supervisor. That spared the 38-year-old from having to take 2 required courses in computer education and technology, and since she's going to school part-time and taking 1 course per semester, saved her a year. Taking those classes would have been a complete waste of my time, Ms. DiMatteo says. These are things that I do every day. I supervise other people and train them on how to do this work. On average, students who get credit for prior learning save between $1,500 and $10,200 apiece and nearly 7 months off the time it takes to earn a bachelor's degree, the nonprofit advocacy group Higher Learning Advocates calculates. The likelihood that they will graduate is 17% higher, the organization finds. Justin Hand dropped out of college because of the cost and became a largely self-taught information technology manager before he decided to go back and get an associate and then a bachelor's degree so he could move up in his career. He got 15 credits, a full semester's worth, through a program at the University of Memphis, for which he wrote essays to prove he had already mastered software development, database management, computer networking, and other skills. "These were all the things I do on a daily basis," says Mr. Hand of Memphis, who is 50 and married with a teenage son. "And I didn't want to have to prolong college any more than I needed to." Making it easier to evaluate skills. Meanwhile, employers and policymakers are pushing colleges to speed up the output of graduates with skills required in the workforce, including by giving more students credit for their prior learning, and online behemoths, Western Governors University and Southern New Hampshire University, with which brick-and-mortar colleges compete, are way ahead of them in conferring credit for past experience. "They've mastered this and used it as a marketing tool," says Kristen Vansolo, Assistant Vice President of Innovative Education and Partnerships at Florida Gulf Coast University, which has expanded its awarding of credit for prior learning. More traditional higher education institutions have been slower to adapt. It's also gotten easier to evaluate how skills that someone learns in life equate to academic courses or programs. This has traditionally required students to submit portfolios, take tests, or write essays, as Mr. Hand did, and faculty to subjectively and individually assess them. Now, some institutions, states, systems, and independent companies are standardizing this work or using artificial intelligence to do it. The growth of certifications from professional organizations such as Amazon Web Services and the Computing Technology Industry Association, or CompTIA, has helped too. You literally punch an industry certification into our database, and it tells you what credit you can get, says Philip Giraffa, Executive Director of Articulation and Academic Pathways at Miami-Dade College. "When I started here, that could take anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 months." Data provided by Miami-Dade shows it has septupled the number of credits for prior learning awarded since 2020, from 1,197 then to 7,805 last year. These are students that most likely would have looked elsewhere, whether to the online University of Phoenix or University of Maryland Global Campus, or other big competitors, Dr. Giraffa says. 15% of undergraduates enrolled in higher education full-time and 40% enrolled part-time are 25 or older, federal data show, including people who delayed college to serve in the military, volunteer, or do other work that could translate into academic credit. "Nobody wants to sit in a class where they already have all this knowledge," Dr. Giraffa says. At Thomas Edison, Police Academy graduates qualify for up to 30 credits toward associate degrees. Carpenters who have completed apprenticeships can get as many as 74 credits in subjects, including math, management, and safety training. Bachelor's degrees are often a prerequisite for promotion for people in professions such as these or who hope to start their own companies. The University of Memphis works with FedEx, headquartered nearby, to give employees with supervisory training academic credit they can use toward a degree in organizational leadership, helping them move up in the company. The University of North Carolina system last year launched its military equivalency system, which lets active duty and former military service members find out almost instantly before applying for admission if their training could be used for academic credit. That had previously required contacting admissions offices, registrars, or department chairs. Among the reasons for this reform was that so many of these prospective students and the federal education benefits they get were ending up at out-of-state universities, the UNC system's strategic plan notes. "We're trying to change that," says Kathy Sidner, the system's director of workforce and partnerships. "It's not only for the sake of enrollment and revenue," she says. "From a workforce standpoint, these individuals have tremendous skill sets, and we want to retain them as opposed to them moving somewhere else." There's one group that has historically pushed back against awarding credit for prior learning: university and college faculty, concerned it might affect enrollment in their courses or unconvinced that training provided elsewhere is of comparable quality. Institutions have worried about the loss of revenue from awarding credits for which students would otherwise have had to pay. That also appears to be changing as universities leverage credit for prior learning to recruit more students and keep them enrolled for longer, resulting in more revenue, not less. "That monetary factor was something of a myth," says Beth Doyle, chief of strategy at Kiel. "Faculty have increasingly come around, too. That's sometimes because they like having experienced students in their classrooms," Florida Gulf Coast's Ms. Vancelo says. "Still, while many recognize it as a recruiting incentive, most public universities and colleges have had to be ordered to confer more credits for prior learning by legislatures or governing boards. Private nonprofit colleges remain stubbornly less likely to give it. More than two-thirds charge a fee for evaluating whether other kinds of learning can be transformed into academic credit, an expense that isn't covered by financial aid. Roughly 1 in 12 charge the same as it would cost to take the course for which the credits are awarded. 70% of institutions require that students apply for admission and be accepted before learning whether credits for prior learning will be awarded. 85% limit how many credits for prior learning a student can receive. There are other confounding roadblocks and seemingly self-defeating policies. CCAC runs a non-credit program to train paramedics, for example, but won't give people who completed credits toward its four-credit nursing degree. Many leave and go across town to a private university that will. The college is working on fixing this," says Deborah Roach, its vice president for workforce development. "It's important to see this from the student's point of view," says Tracy Robinson, executive director of the University of Memphis Center for Regional Economic Enrichment. "Credit for prior learning is a way for us to say, we want you back. We value what you've been doing since you've been gone," Ms. Robinson says. "And that is a total game changer." That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, July 10th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Science of Arizona. Thanks for listening. Good night.